From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Reformers hope North Carolina will change the formula it uses to fund public schools across the state. You'll learn why. The shooting death of a North Carolina state trooper last year is prompting new action at the General Assembly. You'll hear the provisions of the proposed Connor's Law. It can be hard to prosecute a drug dealer when an illegal drug sale leads directly to death in North Carolina. You'll learn about legislation designed to tackle that problem. And you'll learn why it makes sense for government to stay out of the business of providing broadband service. Previous government efforts to provide broadband have turned out to be ineffectual and costly. Those topics are just ahead, but first, Donna Martinez joins us. She has the Carolina Journal headline.
For years now, the John Locke Foundation has urged North Carolina legislators to jettison one of the state's most outdated laws. We're talking about what's called Certificate of Need Law, or some people just call it Con Law. In the Con Law statute, it says that if hospitals or groups of doctors want to expand their facilities, say at a surgery center, they have to go to the state of North Carolina to apply for and receive permission. Well, now a bipartisan group of health policy scholars also is saying it's time to end North Carolina's con laws. Jordan Roberts is the Locke Foundation's healthcare policy analyst. He's here to explain exactly what's going on. Jordan, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we talk a lot about lowering costs, the need to do that. We talk about the need to expand access to healthcare services. That's really the rallying cry. So tell us how these Certificate of Need laws impede those goals.
So Certificate of Need laws, when they were implemented back in the 70s, their goal was to limit the supply of healthcare so there wasn't duplicative services or an overabundance of healthcare in an area. So it would require a government permission slip for any expansion of healthcare services. And what that does is it artificially limits the supply of healthcare in a given area. And when you limit the supply, you limit competition, and that raises artificially high prices and gives the current incumbent market actors way more power to set prices the way they see fit, and that leads to higher costs for everyone in the market.
North Carolina has been operating with these Certificate of Need laws for a number of years now, and since the research clearly shows what occurs, as you just described, why do we still have these laws? Why are we operating this way?
Well, you know, the North Carolina Healthcare Association has a large stake in keeping these laws in place because, you know, they feel as if more competition would lead to lower costs for them. So there's a lot of money at stake here is basically what's going on. And, you know, 14 other states have completely repealed their Certificate of Need laws. So we know it doesn't completely blow up healthcare markets. And, you know, so it's really comes down to just a matter of money.
So analysts here at the Locke Foundation, your predecessor, and now you're on the beat now writing about this, have done the research, have reiterated that there's really negative consequences due to these Certificate of Need laws. But you've been writing recently about the fact that con laws now have the interest at the federal level by a very interesting group. Tell us about the group and what they're advocating.
Yeah, so this was a request from Senator Lamar Alexander. He's the chairman of the HELP Committee up in the United States Senate. And late last year, he asked for input from all the best health scholars and experts in the country to say, how can we lower healthcare costs in America? And one of the and so it was a group of scholars from the American Enterprise Institute, a more right-leaning group, and the Brookings Institution, a more left-leaning group, that they got together and said, here's what we agree on. Here's why healthcare prices here's policies that lead to increased healthcare prices. And Certificate of Need laws was one of the policies that they agreed on, and they recommended that states should repeal these laws.
Here in North Carolina, do we have any lawmakers who are really interested in taking the advice not only from the Locke Foundation, which we've been talking about and writing about for years, but now from this federal group?
Yeah, so there's two different proposals that have been introduced in the North Carolina General Assembly. One is part of a larger omnibus healthcare expansion act that addresses a few access issues, and certificate of need repeal is in that bill. And that would call for the full repeal of certificate of need laws. And then there's another bill that was introduced shortly after that one that it is titled Amend Certificate of Need Laws. So it doesn't completely repeal, but it gets at some of these facilities that really could help drive down costs if they were allowed more unfettered entrance into the market.
Jordan, is it fair to say that your recommendation is a full repeal?
Absolutely. That should be the goal. But, you know, it's a touchy subject. It's very controversial in a lot of parts of the state. Due to the rural landscape. And so, you know, if we can incrementally change these con laws and start peeling back some of the restrictions on some of these facilities, then we could maybe really see some decreased prices and better access for patients.
Do we have any examples of where something has been exempted in North Carolina, exempted from the existing law, so that we can maybe have something to point to say, look at what's happening in the marketplace?
Well, you know, there's some of these facilities that are covered by the certificate of need laws. When they do get approved, for instance, ambulatory surgery centers, they can, the evidence shows that they can offer the same services that hospitals offer, but for a much lower price. And when same thing with diagnostic imaging centers, when they get approved and are allowed to provide services for patients, we see that they can offer significantly lower prices too.
So it makes you wonder, if we see this happening after they're approved, why wouldn't we want more people to be in the marketplace to do that? Get rid of this whole approval process and just let these hospitals or groups of doctors go out. And certainly you would think that they wouldn't be investing in whether it's additional surgery rooms or a big piece of diagnostic machinery unless they know that there's a demand there from their patients.
Right. And you know, that's where the Locke Foundation and a lot of advocation for this comes from, is that we should let private market actors determine where the need is. And, you know, when these groups that get together to open new facilities, when they have skin in the game, you know, that's really where we get the best marketplace competition. Prices get driven down and patients are better off.
Help us understand, if you would, Jordan, what happens. Let's say I'm Martinez Hospital in Matthews, North Carolina, and I decide that, gosh, you know, my surgery suites are just jam-packed. We know that we've got patients who are going to be coming here. We could really help our patients if we had another couple operating rooms. Mm-hmm. What happens? What do I have to do?
So you would have to – so there's a up here in Raleigh, there's a state planning board that, you know, runs models each year to determine the amount of need that is being demanded in certain markets. And so they will accept applications for new facilities, and they will run the application against their numbers to determine whether or not there is actually a need for more services. And then one of the really bad parts of this is that when an application is in front of the state planning board, the current holders of certificates of need in that area can actually submit comments and, you know, basically lobby against these competitors that come into the market and will compete with them. So, you know, it really is a bad system, and it really ends up hurting patients.
Okay, so in my example, let's say that I've got the Martinez Hospital, mm-hmm. And I want to expand, but you are the Roberts Hospital, mm-hmm. and you're saying, hey, I don't want the Martinez Hospital to expand. You could actually make it so that I could not get the expansion permission?
You can you know, lobby all you want. It's a very expensive process,
wow.
And so that prices a lot of people out of the whole process, and you know, that really ends up driving up prices and hurting patients.
What we're talking about with Jordan Roberts here, who is the healthcare policy analyst for the John Locke Foundation, is a set of laws called Certificate of Need Laws. North Carolina is one of the states that still has these laws on the books. You can read his latest paper on this at johnlock.org, titled Reforming North Carolina's Certificate of Need Laws. Jordan Roberts, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. North Carolina has been looking into changing the way public schools are funded in the state. And one person who's been watching the discussion with interest is Aaron Smith. He is education policy analyst for the Libertarian Reason Foundation. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me today.
Why is this such an important topic for people to know about?
Well, school finance is obviously a very important topic. So as a country, we spend about $600 billion every year on K-12 education. In North Carolina in particular, that number is about $13 billion when you account for local, state, and federal funding. So from a finance issue, strictly a fiscal perspective, it's very important because we're allocating a lot of dollars towards it. But what doesn't get a lot of play is, regardless of how much we're spending, so whether we spend more, less, or the same per pupil on education, is that how we allocate those dollars impacts what happens in classrooms. And that's true both for teachers and for students as well.
Now, you have looked at other states and from a sort of a national perspective. When you look at North Carolina and compare it to other states, what do you see? What stands out?
So every school finance formula has its issues. They're all complex to at least some degree, some much better than others. But, you know, I would say an honest assessment is that North Carolina's is uniquely bad in a lot of respects. It's very antiquated, so it stems from the 1930s. And instead of allocating actual dollars down to districts, North Carolina allocates staffing positions and uses categorical allotments. And while a lot of people may not really understand what that means, it's basically there's a lot of red tape around how education resources are used. And instead of making decisions locally, they're made centrally by the state so that districts and schools and school leaders, such as principals, can't actually make decisions with how dollars are spent.
Why is that a problem?
Because you want decisions to be made as locally as possible, because only a principal and a teacher really knows the needs of their school. And so you can compare two schools and look at their allocation patterns in terms of how dollars are expended, and they might get very different results. And so what that shows is there's no one way to fund a successful education. It needs to be locally responsive. And to do that, you need to empower principals to make trade-offs. And so the question is, who do you want making the trade-offs? Do you want state officials to make the trade-offs, district officials, or do you want principals and teachers to make the trade-offs in terms of how dollars are spent? And there's a good amount of research that shows when you empower local decision-makers to make those trade-offs, kids win.
We are chatting with Aaron Smith. He is an education policy analyst with the Reason Foundation. And so given your assessment that North Carolina is uniquely bad in its system, are you encouraged that some folks are talking about perhaps making a change?
I'm very encouraged. And I'm encouraged by one thing to begin with, and that's there seems to be widespread agreement that the formula needs changing, that it's antiquated and it's very inefficient. And so that's a positive. Now, in terms of what to do next, there seems to be a little bit of a disagreement, but I think the idea of moving towards a model that uses weighted student funding to allocate dollars is certainly gaining traction and is something that legislatures should certainly pursue.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to give you an idea of what I think you mean by the weighted student funding, that basically rather than giving school districts money based on you're going to have X number of teachers or X number of textbooks, you would say you have this number of students, you're going to get this amount per student with certain weights added in for special categories?
Yep, for special needs, for economically disadvantaged English language learners. And so that's basically how it operates. And so instead of funding programs such as, North Carolina has 37 separate allotments, like a summer reading program and technology. And not to say those things aren't important, but you're funding kids and allowing district and school officials to actually make the call on how those dollars are spent.
If North Carolina does make a change, is it basically going to be following in the footsteps of some states that do it right or at least do it better?
Not necessarily, but I hope so. And you might be prepared to hear this, but California is actually a model of a state that is doing really good things with school finance. So back in 2013, they implemented the local control funding formula, which drastically simplified how they divvy up dollars. And so they were similar to North Carolina in that they had about 50 plus categorical allotments, which basically funded everything under the sun and came with a lot of red tape. And right now, and so they're about 6 years into implementation, and the early research on it is very positive. Superintendents and principals are happy and satisfied with the change. One big takeaway is that they're better able to align resources with their actual goals and strategies. So what they want to accomplish, they can direct more resources towards those things.
Now, a lot of people will have fights about how much funding is the proper amount of funding. What you're talking about doesn't really have anything to do with the level of funding, but making sure what funding you do have is used most efficiently and effectively, right?
Exactly. So regardless of how much we're spending on K-12 education, there are good ways to allocate the funding and there are bad ways to allocate the funding. And so what I'm saying is we need to be more efficient and we need to empower those who are closest to children, including parents as well. And so what a lot of people don't realize is that a school finance formula is very much related to school choice. And so if you have a lot of inefficiencies in your formula, especially a lot of inequities and where dollars don't follow the child, school choice becomes very difficult to implement. And if you do have school choice programs, it's more difficult to grow. And that's one thing that we've seen in California is that with these changes, they have a very fair and transparent system. School choice has expanded rapidly. There's about 150,000 students now in California who cross district boundaries to pursue better options for their families. And the same is true in Indiana as well. So they made some pretty big changes in Indiana to promote a better funding system. And as a result, school choice has literally exploded in Indiana in a very positive way.
This is not a brand new discussion. And when this has come up before the General Assembly in the past, some people have said, I hear what you're saying about the more local decision making, but some of these locals are going to make bad decisions. We in Raleigh need to be the ones dictating things. Why is that not the right approach?
It's not the right approach because what you really want to focus on is outcomes and not inputs. And so instead of dictating how resources are used and what districts do, you want to focus on how they're performing. And so looking at things like student outcomes and parental satisfaction. And so instead of dictating what they're doing, let's look at outcomes. And one way to achieve this is through transparency. So more transparency around financial reporting and how districts allocate dollars and actually spend dollars. And more transparency in terms of outcomes as well and test scores and being able to actually line those things up and to show how schools are performing, lining up test scores with the dollars allocated and spent.
Well, this is going to be a long-running subject, I expect, in North Carolina. One of the people who will be following it very closely is Aaron Smith. He is an education policy analyst for the Libertarian Reason Foundation. Aaron, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me today.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups across North Carolina all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. It's one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, opinion pieces and reports on higher education from the James G. Martin Center for Academic Renewal, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all in one place, NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Try it today.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation, and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. The fatal shooting of a North Carolina state trooper last year is leading to new action in the General Assembly. It's a bill called Connor's Law. State House Speaker Tim Moore discusses the legislation's goal.
Sad occasion brought us here, but we're hoping that this legislation, once it's adopted, will crack down on the criminals who threaten the lives of these men and women in public service and make sure that do all we can to make sure these kinds of things don't happen again.
Republican Representative Brendan Jones of Columbus County offers more specifics about Connor's Law.
Friends, we are here today to send a very clear message to our law enforcement community. We've got your back. We're also here to send a very clear message to those who want to harm our law enforcement officers. We're not going to put up with it anymore. This bill means a great deal to me and to everyone here today. Kevin Connor was a great man, dedicated father, and courageous troopers whose life was cut far too short after tragically being murdered in Columbus County in a traffic stop last year. Sadly, this happens far too often in North Carolina and across the country, and enough is enough. Connor Law does two very important things. One, it shows our support to the men and women who form the Thin Blue Line. But first, it increases the penalty for assaulting an officer with a firearm from a Class E felony to a Class D felony, a change that will require jail time for anyone convicted under North Carolina sentencing laws. Second, it will double the death benefit paid to the family of an officer who has been murdered in the line of duty. Folks, this is the least we can do. These are small steps, but they send a very clear message. A message that we do have the backs of the men and women who police our communities and their families. It also sends a message that we have a zero tolerance for anyone who harms one of our officers. I am proud to stand here today and every day with our law enforcement community.
What would be the practical impact of the change? House Speaker Tim Moore explains.
The current law right now, if someone assaults a law enforcement officer with a firearm, and it doesn't elevate, for example, to assault with a deadly weapon inflicting serious injury or with intent to kill, they shoot at them, or sometimes shoot into some minor injury. You could actually have a situation where the person, because of their record level, would not get any prison time because the current law states that it is a Class E felony. Based on their record under current law, you know, a person could get off with probation. Under this new law, though, a person has mandatory prison time, doesn't matter what their record is, by raising it from a Class C to a Class D felony. And they could face up to 204 months in prison.
A unanimous state House approved the measure. It also requires support from the state Senate to become law. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
We're doubling down on freedom. At Carolina Journal Radio, we're proud to bring you stories that impact your life and your wallet. And now, get twice as much freedom when you also listen to our podcast, Headlock, available on iTunes and at johnlock.org/podcast. Now, Headlock is a little bit different. It's a no-holds-barred discussion that challenges soft-headed ideas from the left and the right. But like Carolina Journal Radio, Headlock is smart and timely. But with Headlock, you'll hear more about the culture wars, and you'll get some more humor as well. We guarantee great information and a good time. Double down with us, listen to Carolina Journal Radio each week, and listen to Headlock, too. Remember, you can listen to Headlock at johnlock.org/podcast, or subscribe or download each week at iTunes. Carolina Journal Radio and Headlock, just what you need to stay informed and stay entertained. Both brought to you in the name of freedom by the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. When someone dies from a drug overdose in North Carolina, it's often hard to prosecute the person who sold the drugs. A proposal in the General Assembly could change that. Republican Representative Destin Hall of Caldwell County explains.
Many don't understand that the dealers who supplied these highly, highly lethal drugs and profited from supplying these drugs can't be charged with first-degree murder, and really, it's difficult to charge them with second-degree murder as well. Law enforcement's been somewhat hamstrung in using our murder laws to prosecute these folks for anything really more serious than manslaughter or involuntary manslaughter. And in a lot of cases, a conviction of involuntary manslaughter doesn't mean any jail time at all, and often it means only probably 10 to 20 months. So what we've done is filed a bill in the House and the Senate that would give our law enforcement officers and our prosecutors a new tool in the fight on the opioid crisis.
Representative Destin Hall's bill would create the new crime of death by distribution.
Death by distribution is a charge that could be brought against any drug dealer when death results from their distribution of an opioid, including fentanyl, methamphetamine, or cocaine. The key difference between this law and the other laws we have on the books is this law would not require malice to be proved. The key is that prosecutors also wouldn't have to show that intent to kill. Simple death by distribution would come with a sentence roughly in the range of voluntary manslaughter. It would equal roughly 3.5 to 7.5 years. There's also a crime for aggravated death by distribution if an individual has been previously convicted of certain drug crimes, and it would carry a heightened punishment, a B2 punishment, which could mean somewhere in the neighborhood of 10 years. We know that simply criminalizing things, that doesn't unto itself solve the problem. This is just one tool that we want to give these folks to work with, and this General Assembly has done many things over the course of the last 2 years to try to fight this opioid crisis, including the bill we had in the last term dealing with prescription meds and trying to reduce the number of opioids that are prescribed. But we think this is an important tool in that ongoing battle.
That's Representative Destin Hall. He's explaining a proposal to create a new crime called death by distribution. Senate Majority Leader Harry Brown of Onslow County also supports the legislation.
Six people die every day in North Carolina due to drug overdose. And every day, six more families are left permanently and profoundly wounded, often after a long and desperate struggle to save their loved one from grips of drug addiction. We must do everything we can to stop the people who prey on that human weakness for profit. This bill is an effort to address that supply side of the drug problem. Of course, we should do everything we can to address the demand side with addiction treatment, education, Narcan availability, and other means that we can come up with. And this bill doesn't take anything away from any of that, but law enforcement has told us that they need another tool in their toolbox. Another weapon in their arsenal, if you will, to combat this scourge. Most of you probably know that in 2017, North Carolina had the second highest increase in the country in overdose deaths. Law enforcement and state health officials have been working hard to fight this epidemic. We hope to see that we make some progress when we get the new data, for data from 2018. But I think we all know that fundamentally we still have way too many people dying of drug overdose. This bill will ensure that anyone who is working against us by supplying lethal drugs to vulnerable people will be treated like the murderers they are.
Bob McBride lost his son Josh to a drug overdose. He joined the lawmakers to support the death by distribution bill. McBride described picking up his son from a drug treatment program.
That night ended about 11 o'clock with a hug goodnight. I love you exchange, and I thank you for Josh for all that I had done to try to help him. That was the last time I saw my son alive. I found him in his room the next day. The text message exchange with his dealer was on his phone. Sometime after Josh made the buy in the restroom at the mall, Josh texted the dealer and said he had been shorted. The dealer replied with exactly what he sold to Josh. Three of this, three of that, four of those. The wrappers corresponded exactly to what was found in Josh's room. Law enforcement, working with the DA's office, built a case against the dealer, and he was arrested and charged with second-degree murder, along with a felony with 11 felony drug charges on September 14, 2016. In my opinion, the case against the drug dealer was airtight. The dealer confessed to selling drugs to Josh. The dealer said he sold drugs for money and profit, and his entire conversation was on Josh's phone. Everything lined up. So you might say, well, if it was such a perfect case, why did he accept a plea to manslaughter? I sat behind the assistant district attorney during jury selection, 2 days of jury selection, in which she asked every juror, potential juror, if convicted beyond a shadow of a doubt, could those jurors convict this person of second-degree murder? Every one of them answered yes. I didn't get the feeling that that was the case. Even though I heard them say yes, I just didn't hear the conviction in their voice. I think it's not uncommon still for people to think that addiction is a choice. And if you think that, convicting someone of murder for selling drugs to an addict would be hard to do. Death by distribution removes a barrier associated with the word murder.
Cumberland County District Attorney Billy West says he and other DAs across the state support the plan.
1,500 people approximately each year die from drug overdoses in North Carolina. That's up 350% since 2000. And probably the most alarming statistic is that more people die from drug overdoses than from firearms or motor vehicle crashes in our state. So law enforcement, legislators, and district attorneys have come together to try to do something about this, and this will be a tool, the Death by Distribution bill, to do that. And I think it's important to point out that we are not here to in any way punish an addict with an addiction. We're not here to try to stop someone who's being a good Samaritan when they are with someone that has a overdose, even if they were using the drug themselves. And we're certainly not here to try to punish doctors who are given legal prescriptions. But we're here to charge, prosecute, and punish drug dealers because they are peddling poison in our community. It is a violent crime. This bill treats it as a violent crime.
Senator Harry Brown and Representative Destin Hall pledged to keep working on the issue.
I think this is a start, to be quite honest with you. You know, I think we've got to look at other ways we can make things tougher. And so hopefully this is just the beginning of some things we can do.
This is an absolutely serious problem in our state that we've got to do something about. We've been working on it. It's an ongoing process. He's right. It's something that this is just the start.
You've been listening to highlights from a news conference unveiling the proposed Death by Distribution bill. It would give authorities another way to charge a drug dealer after a person dies of a drug overdose in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
A commitment to truth and transparency in government. That is the mission of Carolina Journal, and we are proud to deliver. And now, proud to tell you, the North Carolina Press Association has honored two members of our team with awards for reporting and writing. That's right, we really do deliver award-winning journalism. We shine the light on government spending, reveal the truth about boondoggles, and dig deep into programs paid for with your tax money. We keep you in the know in a way other media outlets don't. And our reach and influence are growing. Through all of our outlets, we reach more than 1 million North Carolinians each month. So make sure you're one of them. Our monthly print edition arrives in your mailbox every month. Our online daily news site, CarolinaJournal.com, has fresh stories, opinion pieces, and more. The award-winning Carolina Journal team, our reporters make government accountable to you. Call 1-866-JLF-INFO for your free subscription. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Local governments should not get involved in the broadband business. That is the conclusion of our next guest, John Sanders, whose recent column posted at CarolinaJournal.com urges state lawmakers to resist the temptation to involve government in addressing a challenge that can be met by private enterprise. John is the Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He joins us now to talk a little bit more about the points he made in this really interesting column. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Donna.
So I think the impetus for you writing this column is the fact that with the General Assembly in session now, there's some rumblings and, in fact, a couple of different pieces of legislation that people have introduced in order to allow local governments to start sneaking back into this effort to provide broadband to their citizens. Give us a sense of what's going on in the legislature right now.
Well, what's going on is there's a couple of bills especially that would try to deal with this problem. And it is a problem. It's a concern that people have because it's more expensive and harder to get broadband technology to the more far-flung areas of the state, the rural areas, the mountainous areas. So it's a market problem. But that doesn't mean it's something that's got a government solution to it, especially in the area of high tech, because things, as you know, change so quickly in this area. I mean, they're talking about 5G and some in coming soon.
I know, and I have to admit, I'm not even sure what 5G is. I'm still getting used to 4G myself. But give us a general sense of some of the ideas that have been presented in a couple of these bills about how it would work and what some legislators may want government to do.
Well, one bill basically would allow electric co-ops to apply for grants with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which has a brand new grant program that would allow them to use their rights of way to build infrastructure. So as far as that goes, I mean, that's an intriguing idea. The problem with it is that it looks like it would allow for cross-subsidization, which is a rather difficult word sometimes to make, so that the electric customers would have to pay for the other parts of the business, the broadband side. And that's the worry. They have to change state law to allow them to apply for the grant. But I don't think that they would need to change state law to allow them to cross-subsidize if they're going to cross-subsidize and it's a money loser.
Meaning that if you are, say, on your water bill, for example, part of the charge would be actually to pay for broadband?
Right, pay for the infrastructure.
Interesting. Yes. So you wouldn't be actually paying for the service that says, in this case of a water bill, water, something else would be added to it in order to subsidize that. John, we have a history of this kind of thing in general in North Carolina.
Yeah, and I was
going to
say much more concerning is the other bill, which would allow municipals and county governments to set up broadband infrastructure for lease to private companies. And then they would do it by basically – they would be allowed to charge either through electric or through taxes or – you know, so the bill would allow for cross-subsidization. It would set aside the level playing field law, which was passed in 2011 in response to what you were mentioning, the history that we've seen in local governments getting involved in broadband infrastructure.
And there was a reason that legislators passed the bill that you referred to just a few years ago, because we have had several different incidents across North Carolina dating back to around, 2010, 2011, something like that.
Starting in the mid-2000s.
Yeah, where we had some local governments getting involved in this. Tell us what happened and what the impact ended up being.
Well, Salisbury, for example, set up a Fibrant network trying to solve the problem of a lack of broadband infrastructure. Wilson did, Mooresville and Davidson, and repeatedly, one after another, you would see the cities not being able to afford it, having to hit up their other funds. Salisbury, in fact, ended up getting their bond rating downgraded because they were getting so deep in the hole. And then last year, their voters finally allowed the lease of the system. The green light for Wilson had been by 2011 losing millions and millions of dollars, and they were having to go to their electricity fund. And Wilson's electricity rates were already some of the highest in the state.
It sounds to me like those governments that decided to do this found that it was much, much more costly, perhaps, than they thought it was going to be, and then they ended up not being able to make back the money at all, so they have to start dipping into other buckets of money.
Yeah, and my former colleagues at Locke, Michael Sonera and then intern Katie Bethune, had warned about that, saying this stuff has been attempted in other parts of the nation, and that's been the inevitable result. You're talking about setting up a private business, basically, through the government, and something that changes quick, and government cannot change quick. And taking 25-year bonds on in some cases to do these, and so they're money losers.
Well, John, what do you say then to supporters of this approach, who say, well, you know what, there's going to be some far-flung communities in our state where private companies just don't want to go to because they don't think it's profitable enough. So what do we say to the people who live there? And that's always the argument you hear. Give us a sense of what you have seen in terms of private companies that are working in the state and what happens if an area isn't served.
Well, that was really interesting. It was the very same day that one of these bills dropped that WUNC did a story about some private entrepreneurs that were hooking up farms using sometimes sweet gum trees or grain bins, or I can't remember all of it, but they were finding some very unique ways to go about dealing with the need for relay and getting internet access to these far-flung areas. It is a market process. It's a market's concern. But that doesn't mean that entrepreneurs can't solve the problem. They are more likely to solve the problem than government, because government really only knows one way of going about it, and that's by saddling their customers with saddling their taxpayers with extra cost to build something that may be obsoleted within a couple of years.
Do we know? Are there examples of private companies already going in and serving areas that maybe in the past folks had thought, oh, they're never going to get broadband here?
I'm trying to remember the name of that company that was mentioned in WUNC, but I mean, there are companies that are coming about it. It's just not as fast as people would want it to be, and I certainly understand that.
Well, John, what do you say then to state lawmakers who might be listening to us now and they're kind of toying with this idea and trying to weigh all of the information and the data and the arguments? What would you say are the principles they should consider here when they're thinking about taking a step like this?
Well, I would say not get distracted by what they're building and forget the cost on the other end. They're looking at it as like, oh, we're building a great thing for consumers of broadband. But they forget that they're also building an expensive thing that their taxpayers, that people in their role as taxpayers, involuntary taxpayers, are going to have to fund. So, yes, on one end, they're getting something that maybe they didn't have or maybe they're not getting as quickly or as nice as they were expecting. But on the other end, they're saddling them with way more costs than they were expecting.
We've been talking with John Sanders. He is Director of Regulatory Studies for the John Locke Foundation. He wrote this really interesting piece published at CarolinaJournal.com. The headline, Local Governments Still Don't Need to Get in the Broadband Business. Take a read of that, and you can get more detail on what John and I have been discussing here today. John, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Don.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.